Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, April 12th. My pleasure to be with you. Hope your morning is starting off well. Still basking in the light of this Easter season. Got a couple of excellent guests in the second hour today. Bishop John Stowe, who is the Bishop of the Diocese of Lexington, Kentucky, the third Bishop of the Diocese of Lexington. He is a Franciscan of the Conventual Order. And Bishop John Stowe will be on to talk about the Pope's new letter, The Joy of Love, Amoris Laetitia, which I'm sure I just butchered the Latin. So we'll stick with The Joy of Love. How about that? But Bishop John will be on the program in the second hour for a couple of segments, actually, to start to break down this letter. It was available on Friday, I think Roman noon, as it typically is, and I began the process of reading it. I haven't read all of it. I've probably read about 85% of it now. It's the longest papal letter, I think, in history. So Pope Francis trying to cover a lot of ground on the title of it, Amoris Laetitia, to bishops, priests, and deacons, consecrated persons, Christian married couples, and all the lay faithful on love in the family. It's a sweeping, probably the most sweeping papal document on the family since John Paul II released Familiaris Consortio back in the early 80s. So we'll talk to Bishop John about his perspective on it, and I've got some good questions for him about it. So many themes. I think the crown jewel of the document, in my opinion, is Chapter 4, his reflections on love and marriage, particularly guided by what's oftentimes known as the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. Did you hear read at a lot of weddings? Love is patient, love is kind, and so forth. Pope Francis, with one of the most down-to-earth and insightful reflections on the interior blessings and challenges of loving within families that I've ever read. So looking forward to talking to Bishop John about that. And then at the bottom of the second hour, Father Robert Imbelli, who's a priest of the Archdiocese of New York and was a longtime professor at Boston College, has written an article that was on the Crux website, Crux, the website covering all things Catholic, led by my good friend John Allen, who's been on the program many times. Father Robert Imbelli with an article about the Paschal candle. If you ever go to an Easter vigil, you know that one of the first things that is done is the lighting of the Paschal candle. That large candle, probably about 3 or 4 feet high, maybe about 4 inches in diameter, that stands like a beacon in every Catholic church's sanctuary. During beginning with the Easter season and all through the rest of the liturgical year, the Paschal candle, fraught with all kind of symbolism and significance, and Father Robert Imbelli will help us understand that a little bit more. Also, the good and the bad of cool Catholicism, a statue for the irreligious, and ranking masters meltdowns. Where does Jordan Spieth's nightmare at the little hole number 12 at Augusta rank among the master's meltdowns of all time. So we'll get into all that. Certainly welcome your calls anytime during the program today. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I want to, let me share maybe a quote or two from this letter from Pope Francis. This was, by the way, a response to or a summary of many of the discussions that took place over the last two Octobers, October 2014, October 2015, the synods on the family, the extraordinary synod, and then the ordinary synod. A synod is simply a gathering, not of all the bishops. If all the bishops of the world gathered together, that would be called an ecumenical council, and that's happened about 20 times over the history of the church, most recently at the Second Vatican Council back in the 1960s. So a synod is usually involves a particular swath of bishops, and they come together to discuss various issues in a spirit of collegiality. And the Holy Father hears these discussions and based on those discussions, then adds his own particular perspective, tries to weave together the things that that emerged as a consensus in those synods and then puts his own distinct stamp on it. It's very much a reflection of the reality in the Catholic Church that we are a universal church. But we do also have, as the Bishop of Rome, he has a particular leadership and primacy even over the other bishops. And as the Catholic Church teaches, there is the charism or the gift of infallibility that the Pope has as Bishop of Rome. When he speaks on a matter of faith and morals, and when he binds the entire church to affirm a truth, he will not err, that the Holy Spirit will not allow him to err. But that charism of infallibility also applies to the entire college of bishops, all the bishops of the world, when they are in union with the Holy Father. It's always this balance between papal primacy and the collegiality of all the bishops is always, it's an interesting balance in many ways, because we have to be careful that we don't err to one side or to the other. And like a lot of those issues in which there's a both and there's a tension between the two, we have to be on our guard against erring to one side or the other. You would be mistaken if you considered the Pope, for example, to be one bishop among many whose voice has no extra weight or authority. You would also, though, be mistaken to view local bishops simply as branch managers of the Vatican. It's not the way it works. A bishop is a successor to the apostles in his own right, and he is, in a sense, the papa or the pope of his own diocese. So one of the things that struck me about the document, of course, is Pope Francis' relentless desire to bring other voices to bear in the midst of all that and to really hear them. And it's really a good model for the way he wants us to hear each other, even within family life. And to hear each other, particularly because of the great respect we have toward each other in our families as people made in the image and likeness of God, and people who have a right to be who they are, whether they fit with our plans or not. And so just to give you a little flavor of this chapter 4, which, like I said, for me is just gold in terms of this papal letter. It's all good, but Love in Marriage, chapter 4, really stands out. And he focuses in on this 1 Corinthians 13 love chapter, in which St. Paul, in talking about the love which is to be sought above all other virtues, he says, love is patient, love is kind, love is not jealous or boastful, it is not arrogant or rude, love does not insist on its own way, it is not irritable or resentful, it does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So the Holy Father takes each of these phrases and then expands upon them. But here, I'll give you an example of a paragraph. This is paragraph 92 on the topic of love is patient. Love is patient. Patience, if you live in a family, you know, sometimes can be in short supply. He says this, being patient does not mean letting ourselves be constantly mistreated, tolerating physical aggression, or allowing other people to use us. We encounter problems whenever we think that relationships or people ought to be perfect, or when we put ourselves at the center and expect things to turn out our way. Then everything makes us impatient. Everything makes us react aggressively. Unless we cultivate patience, we will always find excuses for responding angrily. We will end up incapable of living together, antisocial, unable to control our impulses, and our families will become battlegrounds. I was reading this, by the way, I think it was on Sunday afternoon, and I just had a little disagreement, a little spat with my wife over some piddling thing. We were both tired, snapped at each other, you know, unfortunately. I was reading this and I was like, okay, you got my attention, Pope Francis. Families becoming battlegrounds. Mea culpa. He goes on, that is why the word of God tells us, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you with all malice. Patience takes root, he says. This to me was absolutely powerful. Patience takes root when I recognize that other people also have a right to live in this world just as they are. It does not matter if they hold me back, if they unsettle my plans, or annoy me by the way they act or think, or if they are not everything I want them to be. Love always has an act of deep compassion that leads to accepting the other person as part of this world, even when he or she acts differently than I would like. I see a lot of parallels between what the Holy Father's writing here and what St. John Paul II talked about oftentimes in his writing in terms of the other person existing for their own sake, and that authentic love doesn't simply love another person because of how they make me feel. Authentic love loves them for their own sake, as in elves, not as someone who exists to match my particular view of how a person should be. It's, wow. It gets better from there. We'll be back with more of the question of the day on the next segment. This is the Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show here on this beautiful Tuesday, April 12th, still in the light of this Easter season. My question of the day, always, you know, in preparation for the class, that's later in the day, my one class, in preparation for the show, always read, go to this day in history kind of websites and see various events, birthdays, death anniversaries, that sort of thing, just for little interesting tidbits to throw in here or there. And one of the things I discovered about today is that it's the birthday of the late Tom Clancy, who died back in 2013, I believe. The author who had several of his books, his military thrillers, made into movies. And my favorite of all those, of course, is The Hunt for Red October with Alec Baldwin and Sean Connery and Fred Thompson, James Earl Jones. Just a brilliant film. So my question is, what's your favorite military thriller movie of all time? 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in on that question, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. To me, as I said, it all starts and ends with The Hunt for Red October, which, you know, I've seen the other Tom Clancy, well, most of the other Tom Clancy converted to film movies. And I'm sorry, I think they made a colossal mistake when they shifted to Harrison Ford for Jack Ryan. I like Harrison Ford, love Harrison Ford, but he when I saw him, I did not see Clancy's main protagonist, Jack Ryan, in his novels. I saw Harrison Ford. And Clancy himself evidently had a problem with Harrison Ford being used as Jack Ryan. I prefer the younger Alec Baldwin, even though I probably take issue with some of Alec Baldwin's politics and maybe the way he conducts himself at times. But he was brilliant, I thought, as Jack Ryan in The Hunt for Red October. He is a great actor. I think there was, didn't they also try Ben Affleck out maybe as Jack Ryan? Again, another misguided moment. But anyway, here's a great scene from The Hunt for Red October with, I mean, how can you go wrong with Sean Connery? This is where he is, as Ramius speaks to his crew on the sub.
Old adversary, the American Navy.
For 40 years, your fathers before you and your older brothers played this game and played it well. But today, the game is different. We have the advantage.
It reminds me of the heady days of Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin, when the world trembled at the sound of our rockets. Only we'll tremble again at the sound of our silence. The order is, engage the silent drive.
Aye, sir. Ballast control, open outer doors.
Yes, open outer doors.
Diving command, engage Caterpillar and secure main engines. Doors opening, Captain.
Comrades, our own fleet doesn't know our full potential.
They will do everything possible to test us, but they will only test their own embarrassment. We will leave our fleet behind.
We will pass through the American patrols, past their sonar nets, and lay off their largest city and listen to their rock and roll while we conduct missile drills. And when we are finished, the only sound they will hear is our laughter.
While we sail to Havana, where the sun is warm, so is the comradeship.
Cryogenic plant coming online, Captain.
Comrades, we sail into history.
Союз ни Руси, ни Республик Свободник.
Oh, that's such a fantastic scene. I mean, how do you go wrong with Sean Connery, you know? With our old adversary, the American Navy. If I could sound like anybody besides maybe Leo Brown or James Earl Jones, it would be Sean Connery, no doubt. So if you've got a thought on that question, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. That movie also has one of my all-time favorite actors in it, Scott Glenn, as the captain of the American sub, the Dallas. So anyway, happy birthday. Rest in peace, Tom Clancy. Tom Clancy, raised a Catholic. I'm not sure whether he was still practicing his faith or not at the time of his death. Sports-wise, my Reds went into Chicago last night. When I went to bed, of course, we all know the Reds' success so far is fool's gold. And I went to bed fully aware that it could all end quickly. The Reds were up 3-0, and their pitcher, Finnegan, who I think is a rookie, had a no-hitter going through six. But the Cubs, who look like this year, this could be the Cubs' year. If you're a Cubs fan, that's got to make you a little bit nervous. I mean, it has to be too good to be true. But the Cubs storm back to a 5-3 win, and Cubs sitting there at 6-1, looking like the behemoth of a team that they were expected to be in the preseason. So we'll see how that unfolds. Of course, we talked yesterday about Jordan Spieth's epic collapse and Danny Willett winning the Masters. So kudos to Danny Willett. But New York Daily News with an article piling on, I guess, from Jordan Spieth to Greg Norman, top five Masters meltdowns. And where does Jordan Spieth putting two in the water on the 12th hole, getting a quadruple bogey seven, his entire lead evaporating just like that? Where does this rank among epic Masters collapses? They rank up like this. Number five, Greg Norman in 1986. Largely forgotten, that particular collapse. By the way, Norman with two of them in the top five. Largely forgotten because that was the year Jack Nicklaus won his sixth and final green jacket. But he was in the lead to begin the final round, just needed a par 18 to force a playoff with Nicklaus. But he hit his approach shot into the gallery and made bogey, cooperating with the great sentimental storyline, by the way. Number four, Ed Snead, 1979. He had a five-shot lead going into the final round, finished the tournament with three consecutive bogeys to fall into a sudden-death playoff with Fuzzy Zeller and Tom Watson. That was Fuzzy's first Masters, and he won in the second playoff hole. Number three, Rory McIlroy, who still does not have a green jacket, in 2011. That's when he was seeking his first major win. He was leading by four to start the last round, melted down on the 10th, hooked his drive, took a triple bogey, ended up with an 80, which would be my front nine score at Augusta National. Number two, Jordan Spieth comes in at number two for this year. He was in control the entire tournament, was leading by five as he stood at the tee at the 10th hole, bogey 10, 11, and then the big quadruple bogey 7 on number 12, dropping six shots in three holes. And, of course, number one, and I'll remember this, 10 years after his first collapse, Greg Norman in 1996, as it says, it'll be hard for anyone to top this Masters meltdown. Norman opens the final round with a six-shot lead. After bogeys on 9, 10, and 11, the lead is erased. Then he dunked his tee shot on the 12th. shot a 78 and handed the green jacket to Nick Faldo. Of course, Greg Norman won one or two British Opens, so he finally got that monkey off his back. But that meltdown 20 years ago in 96 will always live with him. And Nick Faldo, of course, the beneficiary of Norman's collapse. Anyway, you got a thought on that? 573-4BREAD-4. Of course, people are watching. I think it's tomorrow night when you'll have the Warriors versus the Grizzlies to see if the Grizz can stop the Warriors' last piece of the puzzle. All they need, this one win at home over the Memphis to top the Bulls' 72-10 record back in 96. It's impressive because I didn't think the Warriors could pull it off after their two back-to-back home losses to the Celtics and the Timberwolves. All right, let's move on to our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. We've always got plenty of those like to draw from. We're never quite let down. So we've got a few celebrating the human tendency to act without thinking. I like this. This is from the Miami New Times. Unlike her husband, Governor Rick Scott, Florida's First Lady Ann Scott has mostly avoided controversy and the headlines. Unfortunately, an embarrassing mix-up led the low-key First Lady to read a passage from a book to fifth graders that described Miami's Biscayne Boulevard in the 60s, complete with descriptions of prostitutes, porno theaters, and drug addicts. Nice rocking chair reading for your fifth grade class. Whoops! Ann Scott showed up at the school in Hillsborough County yesterday to celebrate the students' literary achievements. She often reads to date, and while sitting down with two fifth grade classes, she read from Patrick Smith's Florida classic, A Land Remembered. Widely taught in schools across the state, but apparently Scott and her staff didn't know that students usually read a two-volume edition, specially edited for young people. She read from the adult version, originally meant for adults. Evidently, the passage she read said something like this: as the characters drive down Biscayne Boulevard, they turn left again at the mainland. Cruising down Biscayne Boulevard, its northern section jammed with more motels and junk food shops, service stations, massage parlors, porno movies, bars, adult bookstores, etc. Ouch. Somebody with her team is going to be facing some serious consequences. A second nominee, we're going to go with Starbucks serves man beverage with label Diabetes Here I Come. One Starbucks really got the name wrong on one customer's order label last Friday. A man who ordered a grand white chocolate mocha at a St. Augustine, Florida Starbucks. Why do so many of these stories happen in Florida? Reported receiving the drink with the printed label that read Diabetes Here I Come. Well, evidently, this guy has some diabetes in his family. Two of his sisters are diabetic. So the humor was lost on him, I suppose. Starbucks corporate headquarters issued a statement. Starbucks strives to provide an inclusive and positive experience for our customers and disappointed to learn of this incident. We'll have the winner. Gets even better than that. We come back from the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour, the Mike Allen Show, on this April 12th. Hope you're doing well. Slept well last night. I don't think I slept that well because I don't recall any dreams that I had last night, unlike a couple of nights ago. I must have been in like Deep Space Nine in terms of REMs because it was a dream bonanza and some really weird ones. For some reason, I had a dream. I remember it clearly, but a little vaguely. But I'd remember my wife handing me a large paper grocery bag, bulging at the sides, full of live mice. She said, "You need to get rid of this." I don't know if it's rooted in my phobia about rodents, which I do not like at all. And my son had played a joke on me earlier and told me that he had let four rats loose in the house. So maybe that inspired my dream. And the other dream, I was riding on the back of a motorcycle, riding with someone who was driving, and that someone riding down the road at pretty high clip was Rush Limbaugh. I have no idea. I don't even listen to Rush Limbaugh. There, back in the day, I did, and I'll hear him every once in a while when I'm flipping around. But why was I on a motorcycle with Rush Limbaugh and had Glenn Beck on a motorcycle to my left? Bizarre. I don't know what I ate that night. But anyway, no dreams like that last night. So I'm not sure I slept as well. But regardless, the show must go on. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call. 573-4BREAD-4. I'm asking a question about military thrillers since it's the birthday of the late Tom Clancy, who wrote the story, which I've not read. I've not read any of his books, actually. Too lazy. I'd rather see the movie. And his movie, or his book turned into a movie, The Hunt for Red October. That's my favorite military thriller film of all time. A couple little tidbits about The Hunt for Red October. Evidently, Clancy had a little bit of a difficult time getting people to buy and turn the book into a movie. You know, his books are filled with a lot of military technology and that sort of stuff. And I guess people thought that would not translate well. Evidently, Sean Connery as Captain Ramius was a last-minute replacement. Wow. Well, that's certainly one that worked, no doubt. Connery, though, almost turned down the movie because of a fax error. Let's see. Let's go on from here. The other person, instead of Alec Baldwin, that they were supposed to have in the film was going to be Kevin Costner. Yeah, I think Alec Baldwin was an outstanding in that role. And the other one that was kind of funny, that there's a Christopher Columbus quote at the end of the film that Jack Ryan says to Captain Ramius, "And the sea will grant each man new hope as sleep brings dreams of home." He attributes that to Christopher Columbus, but evidently, the film's director said the quotation was the work of screenwriter Larry Ferguson, who completely made it up. Sounded good anyway. Anyway, let's get back to our What Were You Thinking nominees. We've had two, but we've got a winner. Anybody today can top this one. This in the lovely town of Karachi in Pakistan. Evidently, a hand grenade. The courtroom in Karachi's anti-terrorism court after a judge asked a police constable if he knew how grenades worked. The constable, instead of explaining his expertise in weapons and grenade handling to the judge, opted to demonstrate practically by promptly pulling out the pin from the grenade. Was I not supposed to do that? This resulted in a loud explosion injuring three, including the constable and a court clerk. According to media reports, the grenade in question was a locally developed bomb, which was brought to the courtroom by investigation officer Abid Ali as evidence. The bomb was reportedly not defused. That may have been their first mistake right there before production in the court. It's safe to say now that the whole court knows how grenades work, including the curious judge. Yeah. Remember that. Maybe put a post-it note on there. Don't pull pin out. So if you've ever got a nominee, we'd love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4 or your own incident from your own life could be kind of funny, too. It's always good to poke fun at ourselves. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Still keeping an eye on the presidential primary race. I guess the next big race you've got coming up a week from today, Tuesday, April 19th, the New York caucus. And right now looking like Donald Trump is going to win that one big. I think Ted Cruz's New York values, which he did not use that phrase in a positive way, it's going to come back to haunt him there in New York. And haven't seen the polls in terms of Clinton and Sanders. Bernie on a little bit of a hot streak right now. And then a week later, you've got Connecticut. And then 2 weeks from today, you've got the Pennsylvania primary and the Maryland primary. I guess that's your next semi-Super Tuesday. It's Tuesday, April the 26th. You've got Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. Again, keeping an eye on whether or not we're going to have a contested convention or not, and whether there could be some interesting things thrown into the mix in that regard. One of the websites I go to sometimes is not one I would normally go to simply on my own. It's called A Cup of Joe. It's a website, really, I think, for working women and working mothers that is put together by Joanna Goddard, who lives in New York City. And like a lot of these websites, she has, you know, different sections and different types of stories on style, food, design, travel, relationships, motherhood, and so forth. I think it's always good to go to web sources that are outside of your natural interests and even maybe even some of your own natural philosophical faith leanings to see how other people are thinking and viewing the world. And Joanna Goddard, someone who I think would consider herself very much a secularist feminist. And not that she necessarily has a huge axe to grind or anything, but I came across this interesting article that she had called Motherhood Statue. She says, last summer when my twin sister was having a hard time, I gave her a Buddhist statue of Jizo, who is said to be a protector of women and children. It's small. You can hold it in your hand, yet its weight makes it feel strong and substantial. Although I'm not at all religious, I somehow felt so moved by this statue. So here's a person, right, Joanna Goddard. She's very much a modern secularist feminist, religion not a part of her life. And yet, here she is not only drawn to a small little Buddhist statue, which has a little bald figure, not fat like the main statues we imagine of the Buddha, but this little figure with a robe of some sort on and both its hands clasped together like maybe a server would be at a Catholic Mass hearing the gospel read, and eyes closed, all one color, a gray little statue, almost looks like something could be used as a doorstop. And so she gave this Buddha statue of Jizo, J-I-Z-O, protector of women and children, to her twin sister. She said 2 years before, Kate Suttis, who had written a heartbreaking essay for my website, Cup of Joe, about having a stillborn baby, sent me the same statue as a thank you for sharing her story. From then on, I kept it on our bedroom dresser. Later, Joanne Goddard writes, when her baby Anton was born and she was hit with a wave of massive postpartum depression that threatened to drag her under, I would look at the statue and feel buoyed by his steady presence, even just for a moment. He made me think of all the mothers and children now and throughout history who have been through hard times and needed guidance or protection, or sometimes simply a little statue to look down from their dresser and remind them they are not alone. And then she gives several links so that you can order your own little Buddhist Jizo statue, protector of women and children. I just thought it was fascinating on a couple levels. One, in that human beings are incurably religious. They can deny it. They can say, I'm not the religious type, I'm spiritual, whatever, but there is within the human person, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church talks about this, that we have been wired for, made for God. And that interior desire cannot be simply squelched even through the most aggressive secularist agenda. There is something within us that yearns for something transcendent and someone beyond ourselves. I think we as Christians would say that is the very imprint of the image of God within us. So the fact that she finds comfort in a desire for this little statue when she wants on some levels to be the woman who has it all together is very telling. And so, you know, you certainly pray, and this is one of those examples where there are shadows of the fullness of truth present in all other faiths and religions. because how many Catholics, of course, are drawn to statues of the Blessed Mother, of St. Joseph, whomever saint, because of who they represent and who they point to. The other thing is, though, you know, Buddhism is one of those faiths, I think, that people in the West are appealed to because, or find appealing because it can, on one level, speak to that deep sense of spirituality within them and the fact that they want to find meaning in the world. On the other hand, it asks nothing of us. Now, that's, frankly, the kind of religion we like, one that gives us a sense of purpose, a sense of warmth, a sense of feeling of significance, but at the same time demands nothing. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Isn't that what life is made of? Though it worries me to say that I never felt this way.
15 minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Happy birthday to Mr. David Cassidy, 66 years old today. That was his first big hit from the Partridge Family. We'll look back at some other things in history here now on this day, April 12th, throughout the ages. What have some other things been?
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
All right, so on this day in 1777, Henry Clay, American politician, of course, lived here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from, his estate, Ashland. You can still visit today. Lived to 1852. Known, of course, as the Great Compromiser. Served in D.C. from 1806 to 1852. That might be a counter-argument against term limits right there. I've never been necessarily a huge fan of term limits in terms of, you know, only letting somebody serve a certain number of years. Seems to me if somebody's experienced, then they can continue to serve. And maybe you'll get rid of a few bad apples, but you might lose a Henry Clay there as well. How we could use some more Henry Clays in our politics today. 1861 on this day, 155 years ago today, Fort Sumter shelled by the Confederacy, starting the Civil War. Maybe if Henry Clay had still been around 9 years later, who knows? Maybe it wouldn't have occurred. 1916 on this day, Beverly Cleary born. Beverly Cleary, 100 today, and she's still alive, the author of many sort of tween books for girls, primarily Beverly Cleary. I know my daughter's read a number of her stuff, so happy birthday to the centenarian author. 1945 on this day, 71 years ago, Franklin D. Roosevelt died of a cerebral hemorrhage in Warm Springs, Georgia, age 63. Vice President Harry S. Truman became president. Wow, just 63 when he died. Happy birthday also not only to David Cassidy, but to David Letterman, who is 69 years old this year. Have you seen pictures of David Letterman lately? It looks like he could sit in with ZZ Top. And let's see, Andy Garcia, 60 years old today, the actor. Let's see, and now my computer's locking up on me, so I won't be able to give you the rest. Here we go. 1961, 55 years ago, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first in space orbiting the Earth. Kind of shook up a lot of people in the West, particularly in the USA. Helped inspire, I think, President Kennedy's pledge to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And on this day in 1980, Terry Fox began his marathon of hope, in which, despite his cancer, he decided to run from coast to coast. Cancer would take his life, but he would leave an indelible mark on Canadian and really world culture. He was an inspiration. And then on this day in 1992, Freddie Couples won his only Masters Championship. Boom, boom. Being saved on the same 12th hole that doomed Jordan Spieth. Fred Couples with a little nice, his ball, rather than roll into Ray's Creek, stopped right there on the edge. That made all the difference. So anyway, that's a little bit of history on this day, April 12th, throughout the years. 573-4BREAD-4, if you've got a comment or a remark. Again, our question of the day, it's also the birthday of Tom Clancy, the military thriller novelist, many of whom of his books were turned into films. What's your favorite military thriller movie of all time? As I said, my vote is in for The Hunt for Red October. Anyways, back to this story, this from the Cup of Joe website, which is a website I think largely geared toward working women, working mothers. Joanna Goddard, who writes out of New York City, who fancies herself as a not religious person, she says. She's certainly all in on the on modern secularist feminism, the whole pro-choice angle and all the rest. But she talked about this little statue that's meant a lot to her, this Japanese Buddhist statue of Jizo, protector of women and children. And at a certain level, I think it's an opportunity. And I think we have to look at these moments that we get that can become opportunities for evangelization, not in a heavy-handed way, but helping people recognize this interior impulse for something beyond themselves, even as it's manifested in this little inspiring statue, can really be an opportunity for even the most hardened secularists to open their heart and their mind to the transcendent. And certainly all these other religious icons and ideas, they are all shadows of a sort or point to their deeper fulfillment in Jesus Christ and in the communion of saints. So this little Jizo statue, who's protector of women and children, in many ways a sign of the Blessed Mother, who is the paragon of what maternity is and the image of one who intercedes for us. But the other thing, as I said, it's sometimes people, even though that can be a first doorway to openness, they're content to stop there because a little Buddhist statue doesn't really ask anything of us. We can find all of the comfort of religious faith without that sticky wicket of having to give our lives away. It reminds me of something that C.S. Lewis wrote in his book, Mere Christianity, about the life force that that is sort of par for the course in a lot of Eastern religious thought, this idea that there is no transcendent God, but that God permeates everything and we're all a part of God. It's kind of the mentality behind your Deepak Chopras, a lot of your more New Age stuff. As Lewis says, the life force is a sort of tame God. You can switch it on when you want, but it will not bother you. All the thrills of religion and none of the cost. Is the life force the greatest achievement of wishful thinking the world has yet seen? Certainly worth asking. Yeah, I guess we all do it in our own particular way. We want faith on our own terms and what brings us comfort instead of realizing that to be a disciple means a complete reordering of our lives and a surrender of ourselves. And it's only in that surrender that we'll really find true and perfect freedom. 573-4BREAD-4, if you've got a comment or a remark on that, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. There was a story in the magazine Relevant, which is largely an evangelical magazine that tries to look through a lens of popular culture, ways to explain the faith. And they had an article here the other day dated, let's see, this is from their March-April issue, Rise of the Cool Catholics. Stephen Colbert is quoting scripture on TV. Pope Francis is getting rock star treatment everywhere he goes. And a new generation of Catholics are reclaiming their faith. Will they spark a cultural revolution? This from Emily McFarland Miller. As it says, when her twins were born 6 weeks premature and hospitalized in the neonatal intensive care unit, blogger and author Elizabeth Esther wanted an example of someone else who knew what it felt like to watch their child suffer. All Esther could think of were the words of Peter and Paul and David. And then she remembered Mary, Jesus' mother. She didn't know where the thought came from, she says, but it was the lifeline she needed. It also sent her to midday mass at a Catholic church, wanting to find out more about Mary. That one moment, she says, started the journey for me. I didn't know where it would lead me, she says. Talk about our friend Brantley Milligan, who's been a semi-regular guest on the program, who started the churchpop.com website. Brantley and his wife Krista, students at Wheaton College, in many ways an evangelical mecca where they came to the Catholic faith. They quote Brantley Milligan, who had, like I said, been raised in an evangelical Christian family. He was familiar with Catholic prayers and liturgy because he'd gone to Catholic schools. But when he began studying philosophy at Wheaton College, he read the writings of pre-Reformation Christians, Christians who were unapologetically Catholic for the first time. And so she goes on to talk about these two evangelical Protestants who found themselves drawn to the Catholic faith. Then he credits in an article, she quotes Father James Martin, Jesuit priest, editor-at-large of America magazine, who credits two figures for a recent wave of Catholic resurgence in America, Stephen Colbert and Pope Francis. Francis, as head of the Catholic Church, has transformed its image in the 3 years since his election. And the Pope has been on the cover of Rolling Stone, The Advocate, and Time magazine. Stephen Colbert has jokingly described himself, the new host, by the way, of The Late Show on CBS, as America's most famous Catholic. Father Jim Martin says it. He makes it seem cool to be an intelligent Catholic. You can't underestimate, Martin says, the impact those two people had on the popular conception of the Catholic Church. A few years ago, people's predominant perception was sex abuse. Now when I walk down the street in the collar, people come up to me and say, I love your Pope. That's a big change, Martin says. In the beginning, it was Francis' simple lifestyle that caught people in. In his first moments as Pope, he humbly asked for prayers. He once eschewed the papal apartments and the apostolic palace for its guest house, raffled off expensive gifts to raise money for the poor. In other words, he did things that caught people's attention. Maybe we'll talk about this more at the end of the next hour, because I think this is a fascinating idea. Cool Catholics, the blessing and the danger we have to be aware of. We'll be back with Bishop John Stowe of the Diocese of Lexington. Mike Allen Show.